You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. You've probably heard of the factoid that half of all American marriages end in divorce. Well, it's not true. In fact, the divorce rate peaked at around 40% around 1980, and the latest census data says the rate is actually around 30%. So couples are trying to make their marriages work. But if you've been together for a while, you've inevitably had a rough patch. Could be over children or other family pressures, finances, infidelity, substance abuse, or 21st century pressures like online addictions or technology usage. But my guest today says those are symptoms. The true secret of a successful marriage is in knowing yourself, being responsive and aware of your partner, and learning to live together. Daphne DeMarnef is a psychologist and couples therapist whose previous book examined the beginnings of a couple becoming a family, Maternal Desire. Her new book examines the tough times that occur in nearly every partnership, The Rough Patch, Marriage and the Art of Living Together. It's published by Scribner's. Daphne DeMarnef, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You titled your book, The Rough Patch, and that's a phrase that just about any couple who's been together a while will understand, but they might mean it in very different terms. It may mean different things to different couples. How do you define the rough patch?
Well, I think that's a very good point, because the rough patch really is a term that we are all familiar with, and it can refer to a lot of different things. And I use it in a couple of different ways in the book. I mean, one thing I'm talking about is a phenomenon that I noticed in my practice as a couples therapist, where people would come in either as individuals or as a couple and have this kind of sense that they hit a wall, that they'd sort of reached this point where they felt sad or stuck or lost, and that it usually happened in sort of early midlife, where they'd set up their life and they had their job and their spouse and their kids, but that something was missing or that something wasn't working emotionally in the relationship. So in that sense, I meant it as sort of this developmental kind of moment of crisis or kind of who am I, where am I, what do I want kind of moment, an identity moment in a way. But I also use it in the sense of, you know, if you're going to be in a long relationship, you are inevitably going to encounter various kind of challenges and crises. It's sort of in the nature of being human and it's in the nature of being married that it's not all going to be smooth sailing. So the book is organized around different crises or different issues that people confront, whether it's alcohol use or money issues or, you know, health issues or the empty nest. And I try to sort of walk through some of the typical challenges and how you can get through them well.
But a lot of times those crises and challenges are seriously affected by the developmental issues, right?
Exactly.
How the relationship develops.
Well, exactly. And part of what this book is doing, which I really don't think any other book has yet done, is to look at the fact that we do live much longer than we have in the past, and we also have this aspiration to have long, close marriages, right? And so how do you mesh the development of the individual people with the development of the marriage? Because really, for a successful life, both things need to happen, right? You need to have the freedom to develop who you are as an individual, but if you're going to be married for a long time, you need to also look to the development of the marriage, and that can be a difficult balancing act.
Well, it certainly can, and oftentimes, you know, you hear the phrase that we grew apart. As we worked on our own who we are as individuals, we found that we didn't work as a couple. But a lot of times you can bridge that with good communication and self-awareness and awareness of the other in your relationship, the other person.
Well, exactly, and those are the key ingredients, because growing apart, I don't believe, just sort of happens, right? I think it's a lot of micro choices and decisions that people aren't even aware they're making. And the way I like to think about it is, at points at which you could have turned toward each other and tried to understand something together, you sort of turned away. You know, maybe you weren't aware you were doing it, but I think that it does take this constant attempt to talk, to communicate, to turn toward the other person, to say, here I am now. This is what I need. This is what I'm thinking. And that, by the way, can take courage and take guts, because, you know, we're putting one step in front of the other, just handling life. And sometimes it seems messy and inconvenient to actually have those difficult emotional conversations. And yet that's what you keep having to do in order to keep growing together.
Your book, one of the first things it tackles is this idea of the midlife crisis, which it's almost a cliche in many ways, but I love the way, one of the ways you term this idea of the midlife crisis, it's a de-repressing of emotions.
So the midlife crisis is an idea that actually was created in the 1960s, and that's probably not a surprise, right? Because we came out of a time of a lot of conventionality and roles and so forth, and then there was a huge cultural awakening and kind of revolution in the 60s. And there was sort of this notion that, you know, in order to find myself, I need to free myself from the shackles of convention, which often included marriage, right? And so especially the model was sort of that particularly men needed to go out and find themselves. Then it was, you know, a phase of the sort of midlife crisis discussion where women needed to find themselves. And I think we're in a more sort of, in a way, realistic and maybe sobered sense of, you know, the divorce boom of the 70s and 80s didn't necessarily solve everybody's problems with intimate relationships, and a lot of kids suffered as a result. And so I think married people now try to think about, okay, how can I actually work out this relationship? But I think what I'm calling the rough patch has to do with the fact that when you reach midlife and you've got this whole structure of your life, you still have your emotional baggage from the past. You still have those aspects of yourself that maybe you haven't figured out or sorted out or resolved. And a lot of those things need to be figured out in intimate relationships. And so marriages basically bear the imprint of each person's unresolved issues. And the healing possibility of marriage is that you can actually, through conversation, through trying to understand each other, through trying to understand yourself, actually heal from your past wounds and have an intimate, trusting relationship in adulthood with another person. But the book is really about how you do that.
I guess that gets, again, back to the idea that we are living longer. You know, the midlife crisis comes out of the fact that when we're coining that term, we've gone from a life expectancy of around 50s and 60s to 70s, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There wasn't a midlife to even have a crisis in.
It's like youth to old age.
Yeah.
One of the things you write, I was really struck by this. You said, you know, the idea of feeling with or thinking about your partner, that breakdown is one of the biggest problem areas in a marriage where you're not feeling with your partner or thinking about your partner as you go through your couple's life and your daily life, really.
Well, of course, one truism in relationships, and I think everybody can relate to this, is you go home and you try to tell your partner about some stressful thing that happened, and people will say, you know, you're trying to solve my problem. I just want you to listen to me, right? I mean, people say, you know, don't leap to the solution. Just hear what I have to say and empathize, right? Or sometimes people will say the opposite. They'll say, you know, I don't want to wallow in emotion. Let's solve it, right? And what I'm getting at there, and it's really based on a whole tradition of research and emotion that's happened in the past three decades in psychology, which I'm really trying to bring to a general audience. But what I'm trying to get at there is that we need both. We both need empathy and our partner to feel with us and say, I feel what you're feeling. I understand. I'm trying to understand. I sympathize. And we need them to help us. In other words, after we've done this sympathizing, we need to sort of think, okay, well, what'll help here? And you need to do both with each other. And I think some people are better at one than the other, but I'm really encouraging people to cultivate both those capacities and abilities in themselves. In other words, when their spouse comes to them for help or support or understanding, that they can both listen and sit with the emotion, because that's what we really need from our partners, that kind of support, and be a helpmate, be somebody who can help struggle through whatever the issue is and think about it together.
And that's a difficult role to navigate. If somebody who wants to solve a problem, sitting and being passive and open to what's being said but not reacting to it, is that can be a difficult thing. And I would think vice versa.
Right. So I say that the work of marriage is staying vulnerable. That's the work. You know, people think, oh, it's just, you know, sucking up my emotion and not needing too much. That's the work. No, it's actually being open. That's the work. Because as you're saying, that's not easy for everyone. But I want to take issue with your word passive. And I think that's probably something that men feel more often than women. You know, that if I'm sitting and listening to you, that's actually very active. I'm trying to understand you. I'm trying to bear the emotion that you're raising. That all takes effort and activity. And I think people do, you know, men especially are socialized to fix things, right?
Right.
And they feel like they're not doing anything if they're just listening. And I want men to understand, no, actually women feel you're doing a lot when you're just listening.
if you're listening and reacting to it. I mean, if you are just letting it come in and being passive, then yes, that's not participating.
But, you know, reacting's tricky too, because sometimes someone will say, here's my problem, I'm so upset. And reacting can be like, well, you shouldn't be so upset, right? And then that doesn't feel helpful. So I think when you're listening to someone talk about their emotion, the best stance to take is, I'm curious, I'm interested, I want to know you.
Yeah. As you said that, I'm sure there were lots of people listening going, yep, I've had that moment.
We've all had that moment.
Right. Do your practice, what are the most common rough patches couples are experiencing? The outside, I mean, we've talked a little bit about the inside developmental mm-hmm. part of a relationship that changes over time. And mm-hmm. as, you know, the newness wears off, you know, there's mm-hmm. familiarity and all the sort of issues that go with that. But what are some of the outside stressors that the most common ones?
Well, I think they're very common and sort of eternal ones that have mm-hmm. been around for a while. I mean, certainly financial pressures and money are a huge issue for couples. Alcohol use, you know, drug use is sort of has been around for a long time. Sexual monogamy, affairs, flirting, you know, sort of being a faithful partner is one of the things that people struggle with. I think in this day and age, we all are familiar with the pernicious and sort of invasion of our lives by technology. You know, that has a few different issues attached to it. You know, there's both the fact that there's all these ways to connect to people online that can be a temptation, but I think more commonly just the fact that our devices are sort of players in family life, and the whole question of how they function to sort of distract us and detach us, and sometimes even as a way to sort of get away from the more messy human emotional issues that we might be having with our spouse. It's sort of easy to retreat through, you know, distraction devices. So I think that's a huge issue. One sort of hopeful thing is, you know, as men and women have had more equal levels of education and economic earning power, it seems that those two things are both helping people stay married over the long haul. In other words, more egalitarian marriage seems to mm-hmm. help people. Except, you know, that also means that everyone's doing every role. And while that's great for individual development and for marriage, it does create stresses in terms of all the balls that everybody's juggling, you know, in terms of having to navigate being, you know, equal co-parents, both being earners, schedules. You know, there's a lot of stress involved in just keeping the complexity of that machine moving along that I think is, in the big picture, useful and helpful to marriage, but can be stressful in the moment.
I can understand where the egalitarian marriage could be more satisfying in many ways, but, you know, there's really powerful gender roles that mm-hmm. are ingrained in, you know, through generation after generation after generation, that this generation, the past generation, and the future generations are having to break through and mm-hmm. really change mm-hmm. quickly in a, I'm not sure if it's evolutionary, but at least in these strong cultural norms that are ingrained in us, we're having to change those in a very short amount of time.
Yeah, and it's fascinating to watch sort of on the fine-grained level how that plays out. I mean, I'm in the room with couples who are struggling, right, with their day-to-day lives. And for instance, one very common issue with heterosexual couples who have children is the woman will say, you know, why is it up to me to keep all this in my mind? Like, why am I the sort of executive of this family, you
know? Executive of the home,
yeah. Right, and there does seem to be some sociobiological research indicating that maybe women are better at multitasking, like their brains are wired that way. But it can be very frustrating and difficult within the family, you know, because the woman is often feeling like, I have to keep track of everything, and why isn't this a shared burden? And, you know, the man feels criticized or blamed or, you know, you know, it's just a very complicated thing.
My guest today is Daphne Domarneff. She's a psychologist and couples therapist. Her previous book examined maternal desire. And her latest book is titled The Rough Patch, Marriage and the Art of Living Together. It's published by Scribner's, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa, talking about all the common rough patches couples will experience, from infidelity, financial pressures, alcohol, and the like, to 21st century issues like online addictions, excessive technology use, children, taking care of parents while you're taking care of children, all these things. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that idea that when a lot of couples come together, they think, okay, we'll have children, we'll raise children, and then once we'll grow old together, it'll be an empty nest. But oftentimes that's not the case. You often go from having children to as soon as the children or about the time you're finished raising your children, you're taking care of parents. And it's like you never get back to that couple idea. Mm-hmm. How common is that as a stressor?
Well, I think it is common, and I think it's interesting. My first book was about motherhood, and I remember myself thinking, okay, well, the hard phase, you know, is when they're little, and then they get launched, and it's not, you know, you're free. Once you've had teenagers, you know that nothing could be further from the truth, right? So there is, I think, this sort of mental set that we have, that this is the hard phase, but it'll get easier. And as you're saying, it's always complicated, right? Of course, you don't know what life's going to throw you, you know, what kind of kids you'll have, when your parents will become infirm, et cetera. So there's a lot of variables, and nobody really kind of knows what their particular picture is going to be. But I think there is also a phenomenon you're pointing to in this day and age, which is the sort of launching of children, which I talk about in my empty nest chapter. You know, that can be a 10-year proposition.
Right.
You know, it's not as if they go off to college or move away and then they're independent. And you know, I think what's tricky about it is if you have a good relationship with your growing and adult children, there is such a thing called healthy dependency. I mean, that's what you want with a spouse. You want to be able to be dependent on each other and have that be a good thing. And I think children today often feel close to their parents, and they feel helped by their parents, and they kind of want the help of their parents. And I think that that's just kind of a somewhat ambivalent thing. You know, on the one hand, you're happy that they feel comfortable being dependent. On the other hand, you're thinking, hey, when I was your age, I was already supporting myself and, you know, living 1,000 miles away. So I think it's a tricky thing, and in some ways a new thing for this generation.
I think that's also an interesting, it brings up this other interesting point, is that I think in a previous generation, and you know, who knows what it was like several generations ago, but because the relationships were so different, it was, you know, work was so much a part of family's dynamic. But you know, a generation ago, children wanted to separate from their parents, mm-hmm. and they wanted to go out on their own. And it seems like now, children like being around their parents a lot more, and want to be still connected to their parents' life well into adulthood, even if they have their own families.
Yeah, which, I mean, you figure.
Which is kind of a good thing in a way. It goes back to, you know, really ancient norms.
Right, exactly. In times past, you know, people didn't move away, right? I mean, everyone stayed in the same town forever. So it does seem like it's almost reverting to something that was more common in terms of human history. But it is a shock, I think, to people now, because that's not how they remember growing up. And I also think it's very common for people to be sad when their kids leave, but then sort of feel like there is a certain amount of freedom to that, and then find it sort of a strange interruption and inconvenience when the kids show up again.
One of the things that, as you were writing about the effect of children on a couple's relationship, is a lot of times children mask a lot of the difficulties that are going on in the relationship because people throw themselves into the raising of their children.
Mm-hmm.
How do you make sure that you're keeping those lines of communication open when so much effort is being involved with just making sure that your children grow up healthy and launch?
Right, exactly. That's probably the biggest challenge, right, for a marriage in terms of children. I mean, it's known in the research that, you know, having children does decrease marital satisfaction to some extent, at least temporarily, right? But then the question is, how do you both nurture your children and giving them the time and energy and resources they deserve, and find time and space for the couple relationship? And most people will tell you that takes some effort. But I think what people sometimes lose track of is you can't just kind of put the relationship on the back burner and on hold and figure that in 20 years when the kids are raised, you know, you'll go back to it. Life is being lived forward. If you're tolerating a certain level of alienation and detachment over a long period of time, that is going to have a negative effect. And so people really do, one thing I say, you know, when people ask what's the most important thing you can do to keep connected to your spouse, I say the most important thing you can do is keep wanting to be connected to your spouse. Because what happens to people is they start prioritizing the children, stop having emotional needs with their spouse, and then that's not an easy thing to suddenly flip a switch and get back. You know, so you have to be aware, am I avoiding turning toward this person because I'm feeling hurt or alienated or, you know, disappointed or something? And if you're finding that, your job is to figure out your way back. Figure out your way back to the desire to actually depend on this person and need something from them. And I think marriages fall apart when people basically stop wanting to need anything or wanting to want anything from their partner.
And do children often play that sort of substitution to the point where once they're out of the nest, it means that I don't want to try to fix this relationship?
Well, it can. I mean, I think this happens very subtly with people, but I think that people do sometimes start getting their emotional satisfaction from their children. And I just want to say, as a psychologist, that's not good for the kids. You know, our job as parents, you know, I say that I teach a class to people who are about to have their first baby, and I say, you know, the 18 years is kind of going to go by in a flash, and what you want is to feel when they leave you actually like spending time together. And that is the best thing you can do for them, because then they can launch themselves not feeling, oh, my job is really to take care of mom or dad.
My guest today is Daphne Damarneff, a psychologist and couples therapist and the author of The Rough Patch, Marriage and the Art of Living Together. It's published by Scribner's. One of the interesting chapters in the book, I thought, was the idea of marriage as a story and how couples tell their story, how they tell their stories is as important as what they're telling the story about.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I do have a chapter called Marriage as a Story where I'm trying to talk about the story in our head about this relationship and about this person is as powerful, if not more powerful, than what's actually going on in front of us day to day. And the reason I make that point is that I'm trying to help people see the difference between reality and their interpretation of reality, which is a huge issue in relationships, right? Because we have to be able to reflect on what we're bringing to the picture, right? So if, for instance, you know, my husband leaves in the morning without, you know, kissing me goodbye, right? And I have a big story that I've woven. Okay, so here we go again. You know, he just doesn't really care about my feelings. He doesn't really care about me. It sort of turns out I married a kind of cold person. And, you know, if I'm sort of weaving this into a narrative, that is me contributing a certain kind of negative filter or negative perspective on his behavior that I need to be aware of. Right, it's not that it necessarily comes from nowhere, but it might come as much from the fact that I felt ignored by my father as it does from the fact that my husband forgot to kiss me. Right, so I'm trying to help people really understand something about their own contribution to the story that they're telling. And I think that if people are more aware of that, it gives them more freedom to rewrite their story, to think about it differently.
I was struck by one of the case studies that you use in describing that, in which the person telling you the story told you the story, and then they reinterpreted the story at the same time they were telling the story and saying, well, it could have been, you know, this, but this is how I feel.
Mm-hmm. That was a hugely useful capacity that woman had, and I spend a lot of time in the book talking about, in a way, the most important thing you can bring to a marriage is your own ability to be self-aware and self-responsible. So in other words, she's not only saying, because I feel this way about my husband, it is reality. She's saying, I feel this way about my husband, and maybe I could tell the story differently, right? And that's a huge benefit if a person can do that.
How hard a trait is that to learn if you don't have it?
You know, it's fascinating. It's related to something that psychologists study. They call it reflective function or mentalization. There's all sorts of studies about how that develops in very early life in the relationship with our primary caregivers. So it is something that some people are advantaged, you know, and some people are less advantaged. But I think the first step for any couple is for people to realize that that's a goal. Right? Because the saddest situations that I encounter as a couple therapist is when people cannot see what they're doing, right? So they act in certain ways, they're destructive, the person says, that hurts me, and then they're saying, but you made me do that, right? Or it's not my fault that you feel that way. Instead of saying, hey, I get that sometimes I act in ways that feel bad to you, and I'm working on it, and I'm sorry. Right? That ability to reflect on yourself and be self-aware is in some ways, to my mind, a wonder drug of marriage. Like, you need to have that, and if you don't have that, you're really likely, more likely, to have an unhappy situation.
Earlier, you talked about having courage and guts to being self-aware and responsible for your role, but also having that courage to have difficult talks about where you are with your partner in your relationship. But you also talk about the idea of the golden ring as treating the relationship in a certain way, as a creation in a way. Can you talk about the golden ring?
Yeah, sure. So that's sort of a metaphor I coined, and I call it the golden ring because wedding rings are golden rings. But, you know, it's a state of mind, essentially, that couple therapists talk about as a we story. They talk about as a marriage state of mind. The notion here is that, okay, so two individuals with their own history and past and values and goals and personality and identity and desires, they come together and create a marriage. And the marriage is a creation between them that's in somehow separate from each individual. So people get into a lot of trouble because they feel that in a relationship it's all about advocating for themselves, right? Or who did what to whom, right? So that's sort of what I call the seesaw mentality. It's like, if I get something, you're lacking something. If you're right, I'm wrong. That sort of back and forth.
Zero sum.
Zero sum, exactly. Yeah. And so the golden ring is an image to help people say, okay, so we each have our feelings, we each have our thoughts, and we both place them in this figurative golden ring. And then we can stand next to each other and look together at the thing that we're dealing with, whether it's a problem or a rough patch or a conflict or a difference in opinion or a difference in values. And we can stand alongside each other as friends, as collaborators, and sort out the problem together. And that is, in a sense, honoring the marriage as a relationship that's this resilient sort of living organism between you, that you're always trying to create and you're always trying to construct and you're always trying to fashion into, you know, a satisfying, meaningful connection between you. And I think sort of having this image that it's not that it's back and forth, but it's this thing we can both look at and nurture that I'm trying to help people cultivate. Because that, what I call the golden ring, what other people call the marriage state of mind, that's something you need to have to endure over the long term.
And it sounds like a simple metaphor, but when you invoke it, does it change behavior easily? Does it help change behavior easily?
Well, I think some people are more able to grasp that than others. And so really part of the work that I try to do in therapy is try to introduce this idea and try to help people understand it. You know, it's of course all of us are, you know, muddling through and failing constantly. And in fact, able to access this state of mind sometimes better than others. But if it's a model in your mind, if it's a map in your mind, something you can represent and think about, it does create certain kinds of possibilities. And so part of my work as a therapist is trying to both inspire people to take that on and also to understand it.
The name of the book is The Rough Patch. Daphne Namarneff, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Psychologist in couples therapy, Daphne Namarneff, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her new book is titled The Rough Patch, Marriage and the Art of Living Together. It's published by Scribner's. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.